Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Coming up, the real story of our dig for a princely Anglo-Saxon burial.
Naomi Supor gets excited about wood.
Who knew all of this existed inside wood, you know?
And the constant stream of amazing finds on the building site of a nuclear power station.
Hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek.
Hopefully by now you've had the chance to watch our latest Time Team film, Return to the Princely Burial, The Sword in the Stones. It follows our attempts in shocking weather to work out the context of what seemed to be a sword on the edge of the early Anglo-Saxon cemetery at Cherington in the Cotswolds, and looking at the work that goes on afterwards to research and conserve the objects. Now, if you haven't watched it yet, then you might want to do it before listening to this next bit of the podcast to avoid any spoilers.
Yeah, please do that. Veterans and serving military personnel who are part of Operation Nightingale joined up with Time Team for the dig in Cherington. And last week, you remember on the podcast, Richard Osgood, who's a Ministry of Defence archaeologist and runs Operation Nightingale, was here, kind of whetting your appetite, I guess, ahead of the film's release. Well, he's back, and I guess, Richard, that the gag is off. You can reveal everything. So let's talk about it. I mean, firstly, the success of the dig. As the person responsible for running it in a large part, how successful would you say it was?
Oh, phenomenal. You could see for the people on site that, in spite, and you said the word wetting. You're quite right. It was wetting.
And there was a lot of wetting.
The operative word for that site. And in spite of that weather, everybody was engaged throughout. And I think from my point of view, if people are not moaning about inclement weather and they're just sitting and concentrating, they're so excited, they're wanting to be involved, even whatever level, you could see that there was something special going on. And I think the finds that were recovered, and of course, the two individuals. So it's a really interesting story with lots of facets we could explore later on.
And how surprised were you, Richard, that we did discover everything that we discovered?
I think most of us, if we were gambling individuals, would have thought that the sword was going to be there. I was expecting, personally, to find an individual, a male burial with a sword, very gender specific. That's what I was expecting to find. To find what we did get was really surprising in such close proximity. And it was as far as burials go, it was really rather beautiful, wasn't it? You got the two individuals, both youngsters, next to each other, and it's almost a cathartic pose. One with a sword, one with this just gorgeous, gorgeous item. Definitely exceeded expectations, and I think it would have lived long in everybody's memory who was there. And that's not because of the weather.
How scared were you in the thick of it that we might lose some of the archaeology to the weather? Because everybody was absolutely racing around trying to... I mean, I saw you at one point digging some kind of massive drain to try to cart the water away.
Yeah, I mean, a huge fear. I mean, I know everyone's going to joke that they've actually seen me digging on site because I'm usually the one walking around with a clipboard, not doing any work at all. But I did dig on this site, even if it was simply a drainage ditch. It was kind of archaeology in its rawest, wasn't it? Because we know we joke about being up against the clock. But when you throw into the mix weather that makes archaeology really difficult and you can't move around in it, partly because it's not safe, but also you're going to obscure potential cuts and features. That's a real concern. I think we were very fortunate to get a large bulk of it done in the dry, so we knew where we were going. Plus having experts, having conservators on site, having Jackie able to deal with the remains, being able to talk about the Anglo-Saxon items that we're getting. So we know the sorts of things we need to be really careful of made it easier. I think if we just had it simply with me and the veterans, it would have been even more challenging. They'd have got through it, but I'd have been even more concerned. So having a team effort, really important.
And we're going to be hearing as well from one of the members of that team, one of the conservators who featured in that film very, very shortly. I'm wondering, looking now, you know, a little while on from when that dig happened, what do you think we've learned that we didn't know before about Anglo-Saxon life?
In terms of the box that was found, are we looking at a transitional element in that sort of time period? Because, you know, the burials have been going there for over 100 years, I would have thought. Are we looking at quite a change in attitude in early medieval Britain in that one cemetery and encapsulates that? Maybe I'll throw that to Helen on this subject.
Yeah, I think we are seeing a lot of detail about how Anglo-Saxon England is changing during the 7th century, because the workbox in the grave dates it really tightly in a way that we'd never have been able to with just the sword. The workbox is the one object that it's really hard to argue isn't Christian. So I think we're beginning to see a bit of religion creeping in there, thought of ideology. But one of the things that Charrington seems to be, to me, most important for is the fact that it has so many young people, children, who are being buried in exactly the same way as adults. And that, I think, is also a new thing. That's rare. And I think if you're wanting to think about what's changed, we need to step back a bit and think, well, we've got all these children at Charrington. Let's look at the wider area of children in Anglo-Saxon England and see what that tells us now. You know, a small boy with a sword, he's got a sword, but he's not a warrior. He hasn't got a full set and he couldn't have used it anyway. We need to think about what that means for a place on the edge of Anglo-Saxon England that's presumably where conflict is happening between different cultures. We've got a small boy with a sword. It's complicated.
And of course, he's the second boy with a sword from this cemetery, and the swords are almost as big as them. And how many times do we interpret find as being a toy? We quite often don't. There's we maybe ascribed a ritual or a votive significance to it, but they could just be toys and we're just not seeing the children.
In the end, what we all want to do is to write a story, and Charrington really helps us do that. But Richard, I wanted to ask you, what's going to happen next? I mean, only excavated a very small sample, and although we think we can see patterns, we don't actually know, because there could be hundreds of graves at Charrington. So what is going to happen to that site now?
We've got one area at the other end of the field which has several burials, but we've now got another one at the top end. So are there elements between? Now, there was nothing really obvious on the geophysical surveys that we looked at to indicate the rectangle of a grave. This later one, the two individuals with the workbox and the sword, that didn't show as a grave. So are we looking at a very big cemetery? And it could well be the case. And the geophysics itself, the whole survey of the area, shows there are what we presume are Roman features throughout. There are probably Anglo-Saxon features as well. So there's a lot of archaeology in the vicinity. Now, Henry the Farmer, who was one of the stars in the previous show, he's very keen that we come back, but it's all dependent on funding. These things cost a lot of money, not just on the excavating and the logistics, but also on the conservation. Because if you're finding objects of this quality, you really do need to consider that and how the long-term element of it. Henry's not ploughing this particular field because he knows how important it is. That's a fantastic offer from him. But I'd love to go back, but it's a case of funding.
Let's hope. And thank you so much, Richard, for coming onto the podcast again for the second time in 2 weeks.
Pleasure. Well, I really hope everybody enjoyed the programme, and I think it's difficult not to when you find things like that.
Absolutely. Well, as we've discussed, there are some astonishing finds from our dig at Charrington. The sword that we talked about, the beautiful workbox, and they were taken to conservator Pieter Greaves, who had the job of painstakingly cleaning and restoring them.
Martin and I visited her at Birmingham Museums, where she kindly agreed to sit down with us and chat a little bit more about the remarkable objects she was working on.
Now, Pieter died last year, not long after we'd filmed with her, and we're playing you an excerpt of the conversation that we recorded with permission and in tribute to her career and her amazing talent as a conservator.
Yes, and Pieter was talking to us about the amazing finds that came out of the Charrington excavation, which she'd been working on, including the workbox we mentioned.
You know, it's such a rare object. And yeah, I've never worked on one before. You know, I've done a few swords before. They're always, they're always great to work on swords. But to have something new, something, you know, different to investigate, I think that's, yeah.
Are you wondering what a workbox is, Martin?
Well, yeah, let's break this down and explain a little bit more. What is this workbox? Who would have used it? Give me the details, Pieter.
Oh, I'm not sure I'm the best person to tell you that, actually. I think Helen probably knows.
Helen, let's bring you in.
Well, it's a little tin, isn't it? Yeah. That's the best way of describing it. It's a little tin, a bit like a biscuit tin, but only about the size of a ball of wool or something like that. Inside, they sometimes have scraps of textiles, scraps of fabric, and that's what's led to them being called work boxes. But they're flimsy metal things, and it seems that they're not very practical for holding scraps of textile, are they? So and a lot of other ones have found herbs in them or pieces of plant. This one's got a piece of wood. And it seems more likely now that they're relic capsules, that they hold bits of textile because they're parts of clothing from saints, perhaps. I think they're connected with Christianity, but they're found in furnished graves of women. So they are kept somewhere around the waist knee area, probably dangling on chains from a belt. And there's less than 60 known from Britain, and they're only buried in the second half of the 7th century, which makes them very, very, very critical for dating and interpreting this amazing moment in history where kings begin and the church begins, and it's just so exciting.
So a hugely significant find. I mean, what was it like when it came out of the ground?
Well, we couldn't see very much of it when it came out of the ground because we could see a glimpse of it and we could see how big it was. And you know, on site, we sort of eventually figured out what it probably was. But because it's so fragile, we lifted it in a block. So with all its soil, we wrapped it up and then we put it on the bottom of a trowel to lift it away. That sort of enables us to look at it in a more controlled environment. Because obviously on site, it was a bit wet when we were there, you know, a bit rainy. It's quite a lot of random water turning up. So what you don't want to do is something so delicate that could potentially tell you lots about, you know, if that object could have been full of things, but you don't know. So what you want to do is you want to take it away and then look at it in a really, yeah, calmer environment where you can spend time.
It wasn't completely closed. It wasn't completely shut, was it? It kind of burst apart.
Yeah, so on its side, wasn't it? Yeah.
So the things inside, if there had been things inside, they would have been really, really vulnerable.
Yeah. And because it's made from copper alloy, and that would also, it can preserve things around it. So if you have a textile, you know, some of that could be within the soil itself, between the, you know, so it's all about making sure that you can gather as much information as you can from those objects. And the best way to do that is to take in a little block, you know.
A little block. I mean, the workbox was a little block, but the sword.
slightly bigger, yeah.
Well, let's talk about the sword then. That, I mean, again, another amazing find. Yeah. How unusual is it to find an item like that?
I think I'm in quite a privileged position where I see
swords all the time.
I do a little bit, you know. I've seen, you know, a dozen or so swords in my career. But they're actually, I think Helen was saying earlier, they're not that common, really, in burials.
Pieter Greaves talking to us at Birmingham Museums. And as Pieter was saying there, Helen, that finding swords in burials isn't common at all, really, is it?
No, I think that there are somewhere around 200 early Anglo-Saxon swords known, which out of the tens of thousands of early Anglo-Saxon burials in total really isn't a lot. And they might look like bits of rusty iron now, but they would have been absolutely amazing when in use. They'd have had these sparkling pattern-welded blades. And the amount of effort that goes into making a sword is absolutely extraordinary. They would have taken weeks of work. So they were really the equivalent of something like a fast car in terms of price and effort for the aspirational early Anglo-Saxon man. And if you want to hear more of that conversation with Pieter, the whole thing is available for Time Team members to watch right now via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial for that, plus loads more from Time Team, including masterclasses, 3D models, exclusive videos, and the chance to join us on site. And of course, your support allows us to do more archaeology and make more Time Team programmes.
This is the Time Team Podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek. We're available every week wherever you get your podcasts. By the way, you might be interested in last week's episode where we heard more from the Operation Nightingale veterans who were on hand for our second princely burial dig. Plus, we delved into the origins of the famous Time Team logo. Well worth a follow wherever you get your podcast. Questions from our Time Team members to come shortly. Plus, we'll be following a day in the life of Time Team's environmental archaeologist, Naomi Supal, doing that in just a moment. First, though, I thought we'd take a look at some archaeological news stories that have been making headlines recently. First, let me take you, to where archaeologists have been working at Sizewell C. This is in Suffolk. They've been building a new nuclear power station there. And a few weeks ago, they revealed their very own princely burial, actually, a horse and two people alongside a sword and other grave goods. That burial has been likened in grandeur to those seen at Sutton Hoo, so really amazing. But that's not the only discoveries the team from Oxford Cotswolds Archaeology have been making, Helen.
I mean, what haven't they found? Because this is the biggest excavation in the country at the moment. It might be maybe the biggest ever in the UK. It's really mind-boggling. It's 200 hectares and there's 70 distinct sites that have been identified. And there is literally everything you could imagine there. There's Bronze Age burials, there's a waterlogged Iron Age ladder, there's Roman salt making, and there's also an intact 11th century coin hoard. This kind of thing is very rarely found in situ by archaeologists. But I think, of course I would think this, but the early Anglo-Saxon cemetery, though, it's really, really interesting because of those strong links to Sutton Hoo. So it's got a horse burial, which is also found at Sutton Hoo. It's got cremations in ring ditches, also found at Sutton Hoo. But it's in this curious place. You can't get more on the edge of England than Sizewell. It's very remote and difficult to get to by land. So, well, what does that mean? Very easy to get to by ship. Might they end up finding a ship burial? Well, you know, there might be another one out there. You never know.
Oh, my word. I wonder that all the people building Sizewell C are thinking, please don't find a ship burial. We've got to get this thing constructed. But all the archaeologists are going, oh, my word, we could find a ship burial. That would be so exciting. Wow. Okay, so that is some big, big news.
Yes, these big infrastructure projects are always exciting because they take a random sample of a whole landscape. And so they offer the kind of opportunity that you never get anywhere else. It's a fantastic place.
Let's move on, shall we? And sometimes archaeology can turn up in the most surprising of places. So let me take you to Rome, where builders preparing to construct a block of flats stumbled across two ancient Roman pools. At 4 metres deep and 28 metres long, they are absolutely massive. But the experts at the moment are baffled as to what they might have been used for.
Yes, I find these really completely baffling, mainly because of their depth. I mean, 4 metres deep, what is going on there? Now, to put this in a bit of context, we're talking about the 2nd century BC here. So it's at the height of the Roman Republic, well before Roman Britain and the Roman Empire. And apparently these things are fed by streams, which is logical because this size, you know, where do you get the water from if it's not diverting a river virtually? And they have ramps to get in and out. Around, there are some graves, not in themselves particularly special, but there's a monumental grave. So somebody there has got wealth and power and so on. And there's a shrine with evidence for the worship of Hercules. So is the pool connected to the shrine? Now, my first thought was maybe it's one of those decorative pools like you get in Washington, you know, a reflecting pool, really pretty. But 4 metres deep, what do you need the other 3 metres for? The metre at the top will reflect perfectly well. It is just so tantalising, as we often say. We need to know more. We need to watch this space. And maybe somebody needs to do some experimental archaeology. Let's all build a pool 28 metres long and 4 metres deep and see what fun we can have with it.
Yes, and doing it, I think, in a nice bit of Italy would go down very well with me. Let me take you for our final news story in the world of archaeology to Port Talbot, where archaeologists have found what they think is the largest Roman villa ever discovered in Wales. And they've been doing some geophysics. GPR data shows a huge structure, which, I mean, seems to be really well preserved, doesn't it?
Yes, it does seem to be amazing. And I think that that is partly because it's in the Margam Country Park. So it's never been ploughed. I don't know how deeply buried it is, but it's clearly in really, really good condition. They've released this survey data, but they're not telling us where it is because it's going to be a long time, if ever, that it's excavated. There's lots that the project is going to do before working out which bits to excavate. Given that excavation is quite a long way away, what I'm really glad to see is that the team leader is Alex Langlands, who was part of Time Team for a couple of years. He's a really brilliant landscape archaeologist, and he's fantastic at integrating all sorts of evidence and making the most of sites that are like this, difficult, but doing it without necessarily excavating. So you really couldn't get a better person to be directing that project. What you can see from the geophysics is fascinating. It's almost like a standard Roman enclosure, the kind that's often called the playing card shape, with rectangular, or this one's almost square, with rounded corners. And it's made up of these two huge ditches, one inside the other. And they're interrupted by a gateway at either side. But then inside those defences, and perfectly aligned on them, is what appears to be a traditional Roman villa. So it's got a corridor at the front, maybe a veranda, and a pavilion or a tower to either end, and then rooms behind, bigger rooms at the front by the corridor, and smaller at the rear. It's clearly a site of wealth and power. And the fascinating thing about that is that Margam has been always known as a site of medieval power. It's got this cluster of amazing early Christian stone sculptures there. And then later on, it's got a huge Cistercian monastery. I mean, it's an important place right back to the Roman period, but I don't think anybody thought that it had an actual Roman precursor. So this is so fascinating. And what does it mean that it's apparently a villa, but it's got defences like a town? And how much more is there going to be possible to do before putting spade into the ground? You know, it's such a fascinating discovery.
It really is. And I think a lot of people are getting very excited about it. There we go then. That is it from Time Team News. We're going to have more archaeology stories from around the world very soon.
Now, Naomi Supall is Time Team's environmental archaeologist, and that means that she investigates the environment of our sites. So that can be anything from soils to pollen to mollusks to insect remains. Now, she looks at ecofacts rather in the way that I look at artefacts. Artefacts being things made by humans, ecofacts meaning things that aren't made by humans but are used by them and evidence of the environment at the time. And she's recently been in the lab analysing wood and charcoal samples from some of our recent excavations, and she invited the Time Team podcast along for a little nosy at what that involves.
I am back here at the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew, and I've come to visit the Wood Anatomy Lab to do some identifications. I thought you'd like to see some behind the scenes of what I do, so let's go in. So here we are in this lovely, lovely lab, and it smells fantastic with all the woods in here. And I know people are used to me extracting things out of my soil samples to get some great answers for our archaeological sites. And I just thought, particularly with waterlogged wood and charcoal, that you might like to see the processes that I go through to get those answers. So that's what I'm going to do today. Many of you wonder how I actually look at charcoal under the microscope. So I've got a little piece here, and we get these very sharp blades. And then I want to do is get a nice clean face from this piece of charcoal. And the aim is not to slice it, but you have to listen or feel for the pressure. It's like it will pop. Oops. So then we get our little piece. Oh, this is quite nice. Charcoal is lumpy and it's irregular, and you want to try and get a nice surface as possible, which the image is coming up quite nice now on the screen. So here we've got a lot of the vessels here. We can see growth rings. I can then use an international database, which You type in the different features that you've got with the drop boxes, and then it'll give you a list. You've got more photographs of the reference material, so you can make comparisons that way. I've been dealing with some waterlogged wood. The first step when dealing with waterlogged wood, we take it out of its bag. And all we're going to do, we're not going to be harsh with it at all. I'm just going to give it some running water, maybe sponge some water over it, just to clean it a little bit, so we can start to identify some of the features. Because before we want to take any samples from it for identification, we want to clean it up. It's remarkable how little that you need as a sample in order to put it on a microscope slide. So if you imagine a pencil shaving, how thin when you sharpen a pencil is, what I'm trying to achieve is probably 10 times thinner than that. And there are machines like these here. These pieces of equipment are called microtones, where you can get your modern block of wood and you shave very thin sections. Of course, I cannot do that with something like this. So we have the very sharp blade. And we're not looking to sort of dig in or cut, we're looking to sort of draw a little bit towards us. Okay. Then we lift that. All right. So then we'll take a wee cover slip and we can take this over to the microscope and have a look. Aha! Oh, look at that. Okay, I'm pretty chuffed with that actually. That's probably the best one of the week. If we have a little look on the screen here, see all these little patterns? So we're in the transverse section. Each species has its own kind of signature, its own pattern. It's no different to anything else that we look at, and this is quite diagnostic. So with looking at these features from this and through other planes within the wood, we can utilize the wonderful wood identification database. And then eventually, hopefully, you can narrow it down and then it will show you what you've got.
That is fascinating, isn't it? To see how little you need for a sample and how, when you pop it under a microscope, what an enormous amount of evidence you can get out of it.
Really, really interesting. I just like seeing a day in the life of Naomi and really, really interesting stuff. Now, I've got some good news about the Time Team shop. Hooray! A great place to go for everything from, I don't know, t-shirts and hats to books and God, goodness knows what, all while supporting the archaeology that we do and the programs that we make. Now, for the last little while, the shop has been closed because we've been making some improvements, but I am pleased to report it is back open for UK customers with international shipping coming very soon. So, get to the shop as soon as you possibly can. As we move on to questions from Time Team members, and I'm going to start with this one from Kenneth, who says, and this has actually been asked by a few people. So Kenneth says, why did we go from calling it BC and AD to BCE and ACE? And Michael Crouch has got a similar question. BC and AD, or is it BCE and CE? I'm so confused. I'm baffled. So BC is before Christ, AD is Anno Domini, BCE is what? Before Common Era and mm-hmm. Common Era, or after Common Era? And what? Why have we changed?
Well, yeah, to a certain extent, I'm a bit baffled too. We changed in theory because it was more inclusive. And that if we're mentioning Christ, as in before Christ and Anno Domini in the year of our Lord, some people felt that this implied that we were privileging Christianity over other religions. There had been this term common era in use since earlier than you might think, actually. It's been in use since the early 18th century. They tried out a few things then to replace Anno Domini, and I much prefer one of the other ones they tried, which was the vulgar era, as opposed presumably to the civilised or the genteel, the tasteful era. On the whole, I feel that using the initials BC and AD doesn't really imply anything other than just a convenient kind of label. It's a bit like we say the Bronze Age, but in that era, wood and bone were probably much more commonly used than bronze. So we just call it the Bronze Age because that's a convenient label to hang it on. And because we always use just the initials, I don't see what the problem is. And I do speak as somebody who isn't a Christian, it doesn't offend me. The problem is that we're never going to be able to take the numbers away. That break between the negative numbers and the positive numbers is always going to stay in that same place around the time of the birth of Jesus, whatever you think of Jesus.
I think you've almost accidentally there hit on what the answer is. Let's just remove the letters completely and let's just go positive and negative numbers. You know, it's 320 or it's minus 320. And there we go. And everybody's happy. Let's move on to the next question. And I really like this question from Rose here, who says, are there many knitting needle finds? I hear a lot about drop spindles being found, but hear so little about the tools needed for further down the production line. What do we know about the invention of the knitting needle?
I am so glad you asked, Rose, because this has been one of my little amateur interests for years and years and years, ever since my sister recommended to me a book by the Bishop of Leicester called A History of Hand Knitting. When you're a knitter, as my sister is, you know that you can make these warm, cosy garments that are stretchy. They're tailored to the body. They have no waist. And you can make them essentially with what is two sticks. I mean, the technology is very, very simple. Are they not the earliest and simplest forms of textile production? That would be common sense, wouldn't it? But I've always thought that common sense is not a good guide to the past. Now, if you compare a loom to that, after you've done all the spinning, you then have to set up this giant machine and painstakingly weave your weft in and out of your warp. I mean, this thing, the warp-weighted loom, the standard simple loom, is going to take up half your house. So why is weaving the technology of the past and not knitting or crochet when you think it is common sense to make these simple technologies first and then come on to the more complicated ones later? Common sense. Innovation. These clever innovations are actually much, much rarer than you think. Crochet, weirdly, doesn't seem to have been invented until the 19th century. And knitting isn't an awful lot older, not in the great scheme of the whole of human history. Our earliest evidence is 11th century Egypt, and that is 11th century AD, not BC. It's not minus 11th century. It is in the medieval period.
I think you'll find it's CE.
Or whatever. We don't get knitting in England until the 16th century. It takes ages to filter through from the Mediterranean. But the next point in our story comes with Queen Victoria. Apparently, she was a keen hand knitter. She was very instrumental in promoting knitting, particularly during the Crimean War. And this is where the weirdness comes in. There is a huge link between war and knitting. So that as mass participation war comes in, so we've got the Crimea, the Boer War, First World War, Second World War, knitting is one of those things that can be done by the women at home on the home front as a patriotic duty or to keep in touch with their menfolk at the front. It's really after the First World War that the knitted jumper becomes absolutely ubiquitous. You have the twin set and you develop all the crew necks and the polo necks and the turtlenecks and the funnel necks for jumpers, which have just never been in fashion before. The woolly jumper just doesn't really exist. Before anybody emails us and says, but what about Viking socks? There are Viking socks. Yes, I know there are Viking socks. And the word sock is used by the, in Old English, it's used by the Anglo-Saxons. But these seem to be not knitted socks. They're a thing called nullbinding. I think that's how you pronounce it. And nullbinding's done on a frame, as I understand it, a small frame of limited area. It's like halfway between weaving and knitting. Knitting is so great. It's so wonderful. It's so unique. And yet it's so recent. It is absolutely extraordinary. So thank you, Rose, for allowing me to witter on about knitting. I can do it forever, but I'll stop now. The embarrassing thing is, although I can talk about it, I can't actually knit. I kind of know how to, but I'm not very good at it. So please don't ask me to knit anything.
Okay, well, I wasn't going to, but it's good to know that it would be wasted if I did. Rose, thank you for that question. And yes, thank you for all of the questions that keep coming in. Please do keep sending them. If you're a Time Team member, you can ask a question on the very special community section chat. Very easy to find. Just click on the community and chat, and it's obvious what you do there to get a question to us. If you want to be a Time Team member, that is how you get access to that, but also all of the other things that we do as part of our special offerings to Time Team members. So the masterclasses, the 3D models, all of that sort of stuff. It's all there. Patreon.com/timeteamofficial is where you need to go to access it.
Now, next week is something a bit special. We're bringing you the podcast that we recorded at Time Team's party, our 5-year anniversary of the reborn Time Team, which we had at a pub in London. Now, the whole team got together and we're letting you in on the chats that we had around our, well, in some cases, pints, in other cases, a large gin and tonic. Martin tried to get us to answer questions, and the results were, I think it's fair to say, variable, Martin. So, and I haven't listened to this. I'm so looking forward to seeing what you made of the slightly boozy conversations that I think it's fair to say we had.
Yes, drink was consumed and questions were answered. It's a bit of fun. It was quite loud, but it's well worth a listen. And you'll be able to hear that next week on the next edition of the Time Team Podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.